Michael Tonsmeyer joins me to talk about New England IPAs. This is Beersmith Podcast number 166.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 166, and it's late February 2018. Michael Tonsmeyer joins me to discuss New England IPAs. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a great online learning platform at learn.beerandbrewing.com, where you can take a wide variety of online courses in brewing. They have an offer code, BEERSMITH2018, that gives you 20% off when you sign up for any of their online courses. Learn more about brewing at learn.beerandbrewing.com. And also the new BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can download recipes right from the Beersmith Cloud and send updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers that lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your free 21-day trial from beersmith.com today. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Michael Tonsmeyer. Michael is author of the book Sour Beers, as well as author of the blog The Mad Fermentationist. Michael is also an award-winning brewer, certified beer judge, and is opening a new brewery called Sapwood Cellars in Columbia, Maryland, which we'll talk about in just a minute. Hey, Michael, it's great to have you on the show.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Brad.
So I understand you're in the middle of opening a new brewery.
Yeah, no, it's been going on for about a year and a half now, but finally we've gotten to the stage where we have a location. I'm working with Scott Janish, who also runs a terrific blog, and he has a big focus on New England IPAs or Northeast IPAs. Mm-hmm. And so it's a style that I'm really passionate about and a style that we'll be brewing a lot of, hopefully sometime this summer when we get open.
And when do you open up?
Looking like June at this point. Have submitted our TTB. We're about to submit our Maryland local licensing and just waiting on the brew house and the tanks. It'll be a 10-barrel brew house and we'll have a nice big tasting room for about 150 people, loads of barrels for sour beers and loads of fresh IPAs on tap.
Nice. That sounds like a lot of fun. I have to go up there.
We'd love to have you. Yeah.
Yeah. Not that far from here, really.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned a few weeks ago you wanted to actually talk about New England IPAs. You've been brewing a lot of them lately. So maybe you can just tell us about how you got into brewing New England IPAs.
Sure. It's really been a slow evolution for me. Honestly, I recently posted a link to an old recipe I developed for Modern Times for a hoppy wheat beer. And someone said, hey, this kind of looks like a New England IPA. What do you think the difference is? And really, it's just been this slow evolution in terms of looking more for hop aroma, hop flavor, rather than just bitterness. I think I've noticed that very few breweries now are bragging about the high number of IBUs. It used to be that everyone would say, oh, my beer is the best. It has 150, 200, 300 IBUs.
Of course, you can't actually taste that, right?
Oh, exactly. And now people tend to brag about I'm doing 5 pounds per barrel of dry hopping or 10 pounds per barrel of dry hopping. And that has some of the same, you're not going to get as much from pound number 9 as you did from pound number 1. But there isn't the same sort of saturation that you might get with IBUs. Looking for a sort of more rounded mouthfeel without being so dry and minerally. Looking for softer flavors, more drinkable. To me, I really try to brew beers that I want to drink more than one of, and that's New England IPAs really hit that point for me.
And let's start with a definition of which the style actually is. What is a New England IPA? Since it's not defined, I don't think it's defined as a separate style in the BJCP style guide, right?
No, and Gordon is very resistant to it. He was joking around last time we were talking about black IPAs and that he'd put all these effort into the black IPA style guidelines because specialty beer was just loaded with black IPAs and now almost no one enters them. And so they're taking their time, which is, I think, good, because it's still very much a style that's in its infancy. It's really been maybe the last 5 years or so that's come into focus. The Alchemist with Hetty Topper up in Vermont was one of the first breweries to do sort of again, but it was almost something on the way to this style. It is still very much a different beer than what places like Trillium and Treehouse and Tired Hands and Other Half and now Modern Times and Monkish and all these breweries on the West Coast, they're picking up on it. And so there's still a great range to it. But in general, I would say that the sort of the primary differences are lower bitterness. And some of them are very low bitterness. Some of them almost taste like fruit juice. It's this intensely almost sweet, fruity hop flavor with almost below, you know, I won't say below threshold IBUs, but certainly lower than you might expect in a, you know, even just an American pale ale or an American wheat beer or something like that, you know, 25, 30, 40 IBUs. Huge hop aroma, huge fresh, but without that sort of green grassy flavor that I associate with West Coast IPAs. When I think of a Pliny the Elder or when I think of a Stone Ruination, I think of smelling almost that same aroma you get from sticking your nose into a bag of hops when you are opening it up. And if they're good hops, that's, you know, sort of the goal of the West Coast IPA.
Yeah, Pliny's what Simcoe, I think, which of course is a Northeast hop or Northwest hop.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that big, you know, some pine, some resin, and maybe some citrus too, and some fruitiness. You know, there certainly are some that have a little bit of those tropical flavors, but that's what you really get a lot of in New England IPAs. It tends to be more tropical, citrus, orange, those sorts of flavors. Very little of the pine, dank, resin end of things. Although I think a little bit of that can help cut through that really overly sweet, overly juicy character that some of them have. And we'll talk about it later, but the appearance is certainly a big deal too. The haze.
What's the haze all about?
And there's a lot of argument about this still. And that's, to me, one of the fun things about this style. For me, I don't brew it intentionally to get haze. I just think that if you brew it with the right amount of hops, the right timing, the right grain bill, that haze is sort of a naturally emergent property of the beer. Mm-hmm. I get these emails from people who say, oh, you know, I made this beer and it's not hazy enough, but it tastes great. To me, I think that's fine. You know, I wouldn't go throwing flour in the boil or applesauce that some people do to add pectin.
Applesauce. I hadn't heard of that one. I've heard of the flour in the boil, but
yeah, it adds a pectin haze. So just like, you know, sometimes you've been doing a lot of meads, you know, some meads can get that hazy character from
ciders, pectin. Yeah.
Ciders too. Exactly. And that's an option and there are clouding agents, tannol A or tannol B. One of those is a colloidal stability addition. And again, I mean, there are things you can do if you really want haze. It's the same thing that Hefeweizens run into. But a big difference is a well-made New England IPA shouldn't be loaded with yeast. The haze isn't just loads of yeast that is in suspension. I've talked to a bunch of great breweries that have centrifuges and run all their New England IPAs through there and claim that they have fewer yeast cells in you know, their beers than a lot of just traditional IPAs, that it's not a yeast thing. And I think that's one of the big problems with some commercial versions and some homebrewed versions is that there is still just sort of a murky, muddy, suspended hop particulate, suspended yeast. And that's not what you want. You don't want it to be muddy. You want it to be, if anyone's watching on the video right now,
you know,
sort of a glowing yellow, hazy, but not, you know, muddy. There's no particulate in there. That's sort of the goal of the appearance.
For those of you on the audio, it almost looks like a Hefeweizen, from a distance at least. Yeah,
exactly. But often very flocculent yeast are used as opposed to a Hefeweizen yeast that can be very low flocculation.
Right. Well, what's the history behind the style? I think it's a pretty recent innovation, right?
Yeah. So the Alchemist, I've stumbled into, probably isn't the right word, but they were certainly on the cutting edge of this. But Hetty Topper and the other beers they brew are sort of almost halfway in between the West Coast IPAs, the English IPAs, and sort of this new emergent New England IPA, Northeast IPA thing. They use an English derived yeast strain called Conan that adds a lot of sort of peachy and bright flavors. But their beers too have a higher, more minerally sulfate content to their water, so they don't have quite the rounded, pillowy body that New England IPAs can have. and sort of a brighter, fresher, more resiny hop flavor. And so that was sort of the first one sort of on that, you know, way post on the way to this. I've talked to JC from Trillium,
how long ago was that? Just roughly when did they start?
Heady Topper now, and they've been canned that for maybe 6 or 7 years, something like that. It had been around before that, but that's when they started canning it at their new location. That's when it really sort of started to get a life of its own. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to JC at Trillium. We go back to our homebrew blogging days, and he was saying that, you know, he never really set out to mimic what Alchemist or anybody else was doing. They just had an English yeast in-house for their porter or for their stout or, you know, their dark beer, and decided that, you know, rather than having yet another strain, they would just use the same English yeast for their hoppy beers. And they came out a little cloudy, but they also had this great, beautiful, you know, the yeast esters mixing with the hop aromatics and sort of building on that fruitiness, and that they liked it. And so they just kept going with it. And between them and Treehouse, and that's sort of in the last 5 or 6 years that they've both really opened and ramped up. And now they're both running giant breweries from little tiny places. I think Trillium's got 90 barrel tanks and Treehouse is doing 240s. So these beers that used to be sort of small and niche are really garnering a lot of attention.
Yeah, that's almost getting in a regional brewing category, right?
Yeah, except for these places are selling almost 100% of it packaged out the door. I mean, people line up for 2 hours and walk out with
right out of the tap room.
$600 worth of cans going down the street.
Wow. Well, how's it different than a typical West Coast IPA? You talked about some of the differences, the hops used, for example.
Yeah, for the hops, to me, it's less about what hops you would use, because I think sort of a classic American IPA, you can use almost any bold hop. It's more about the hops that you wouldn't use. So I tend to think of this as a style that you're not going to be dry hopping with something like Columbus or Equinaut or and any of those really sort of earthy hops. It draws a lot of those Pacific Northwest hops. I mean, Citra, Mosaic are two big classics. And then, of course, like Simcoe and Amarillo and a lot of those. And then sort of big on the Southern Hemisphere hops. Galaxy is a big one. And a lot of brewers claim the Galaxy has a specific oil content that lends itself to producing that haze. Mm. And then Nelson Savin and Motueka and a lot of these, I've started playing with some of these newer hop varieties. I'm not entirely sold on any of them yet as sort of a perfect one, but the one I'm drinking right now is Mosaic and Belma. But on the hot side, I've really leaned towards using sort of less expensive hops. I do use Columbus on the hot side. I do use Simcoe a lot. They a lot of those sort of more catty flavors, the 4 MMP, get blown off. And if you're adding it on the hot side, you're really not going to end up with a beer that's too herbal or too grassy or anything like that. And then I save my really good hops that, you know, I may not have an unlimited amount of, or the price is higher for the cold side for dry hopping a couple of times.
And the other major differences with the West Coast IPAs?
Oh, sure. They tend to have a much rounder mouthfeel, and a lot of that is grain bill derived. So the classic West Coast, you know, double IPA is pale malt, maybe a little carapils, maybe a little sugar, maybe a little tiny, you know, crystal 10 or crystal 20. The big thing that New England IPAs add is generally some sort of high protein adjunct grain. So oats are classic, flaked wheat is classic. I've done a lot of chit malt. And for those who don't know, chit malt is a really under-modified German malt. It was originally developed to sort of up the protein content if you were doing a decoction or if you were brewing a Berliner Weiss or something like that, where there isn't a lot of malt, but you still want to have all those great proteins for head retention. And so that's something that I've been doing. I've gotten as high as 50% chit malt, that it's just sort of a very low alcohol IPA, and that worked out okay. But otherwise, I've done 10 to 15% is sort of my sweet spot for that.
And are you adding that for haziness or body or what?
You know, it's really, I love head retention. And I love chit malt. Really, it doesn't make the head last much longer than a standard beer. But while it lasts, it has this density to it. This when you have a sip of it, just this coating fullness to the body. And that's one of the big things about this style is that people really are obsessed with mouthfeel. And that's something Hill Farms has, Sean Hill from Hill Farms has long talked about, that mouthfeel is the thing that keeps him up at night, that he loves a beer that has that, you know, just fullness to the body. And that's, you know, sort of his IPAs are terrific for that, but also it's amazing what he does for, you know, the stouts and the porters and the darker beers. And water treatment is a big part of that too. Classic West Coast is very high towards sulfate. You add a lot of gypsum to the water, probably not as much as sort of the classic English Burtonization, but you're adding 150, 200, 250, maybe 300 parts per million of sulfate to your water. And for the New England IPAs, it's more towards chloride. So calcium chloride is, it helps add roundness, a fullness to the body. And then a lot of debate.
So chloride gives you, I'm trying to remember, chloride sulfate ratio, right? So chloride's going to give you a more malty mouthfeel, I would think, right?
Exactly. And it's not that it accents malt flavor, but it certainly gives it more of that fullness and more of that substance to it. It's not going to be as crisp. It's not going to finish with that sort of lingering bitterness. Chloride helps to
soften it, right?
Exactly. And that's a word that people often use for these. But exactly how much chloride is a topic of big debate. There are people who, and we can certainly talk ratios or we can talk raw numbers. I think both are important. Yeah. In the same way that you could have a 10-to-1 ratio that's 10 parts per million to 1 part per million, well, it's not going to be the same as 100 to 10 or 1,000 to 100. Even though the ratio is still 10 to 1.
Of course.
Yeah. And so for me, I've been really happy around 150 parts per million of each. But there are a lot of people who will go even more towards the chloride. They might go between 150 and 200 parts per million chloride and maybe 50 to 100 sulfate, something like that.
So like a 2-to-1 ratio, I guess.
Yeah.
Because so 1-to-1 is pretty neutral, really. I mean, it's exactly. not what you expect. Like you said, if you go with a traditional IPA, they're probably going to push more, sulfate into it, right?
Exactly. Probably 2-to-1 the other way or 3-to-1 the other way.
Right.
The nice thing about these minerals, though, is you can dose them to taste because they aren't, they don't have a big impact on the actual process of the beer. So as long as you're hitting your mash pH and you didn't need that extra calcium, you can just dose in, you know, mix up a little with some distilled water and eyedropper it into the finished beer, taste it, see if what you get from it, what a good ratio for you is. Hmm. I recently did an article for BYO where I sent in a sample of the water I used to brew a New England IPA and then a sample of the finished IPA as well to Ward Labs to get readings on how the mineral content changed through, you know, adding the malt and the hops and fermentation, all of that. It was really surprising. I mean, both chloride and sulfate really spiked up hugely. And so, again, part of that is now it makes me sort of question, hey, if I'm doing a double IPA, I'm going to get a lot more minerals from the grain. Should I go easier on the minerals in the water treatment? And conversely, if I'm doing a really low alcohol beer, should I add more of these minerals to sort of compensate for what I'm not getting from the grain?
Yeah, I don't know. I think most of the water profiles are obviously done before you brew. So that's kind of factored in, I would think.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people will use the same water profile if they're brewing a session IPA or an IPA or a double IPA or a triple IPA. And that's, I think there's some room to explore there. And honestly, part of it is I don't have any great answers at the moment. It's just one of those things I've been thinking about a little bit more. I'm really trying to dial in water profile, not just for a general style, but for a specific beer. But yeah, it's just something, you know, chloride and sulfate ratios are something to play with and dial into your own taste and probably have to do with the ideal ratio will probably depend on how many IBUs you're getting and how much other bittering compounds you might be getting from the dry hops or from, I've been playing around with all of these isomerized hop extracts as well, hexalone and tetralone. Tetralone is what Miller uses to make their beers so that they can put them in clear bottles and they won't get light struck.
And of course, just for folks that don't know, isomerized alpha acids, those are the ones that are have already been pre-boiled, if you will, right? And so
exactly.
You really just add them at the end if you want to add more bitterness at the end right to the beer.
Exactly. And I'm not adding them necessarily for bitterness. I'm only adding maybe 5 or 6 IBUs, but they have very strong sustaining ability. So they sort of combine with that chit malt. The chit malt gives you the sort of creamy head and the hexalone of the tetralone gives you a longer retention. And so I've just been adding a little bit, you know, 1 gram in the keg for 5 gallons. As also I've been playing with that for a couple other things that, you know, sour beers where head retention is always a trouble. But in these beers, hexalone in particular is supposed to give more rounded mouth feel, a fuller palate. And so that's something, you know, I try and get every advantage I can.
So you already talked a little bit about grain bills, but let's go back and define a typical Northeast IPA. What would you recommend for a grain bill starting from the beginning?
Sure. Base malt's the first sort of big consideration. And again, it's a place where there isn't a perfect answer. So the Alchemist are big on Thomas Fawcett's, English pale malt. They've got a great bready flavor. For me, particularly in the more sort of, I guess, more recent New England IPAs, that sort of clashes with the fruity, juicy, tropical kind of flavors. Mm-hmm. And so if I was going to use an English malt, it might be something like Golden Promise that's a little bit softer, that doesn't have quite the biscuity, you know, whatever you want to call it, English thing, or a blend. And I'm big on blending base malts. A lot of breweries are doing a mix of American pale and just the American two-row brewer's malt that's very pale and doesn't have a lot of malt character. Although, honestly, most of the time, I just go for my base malt straight up American two-row brewer's malt. Just I'm looking for the malt mostly to stay out of the way of all the other ingredients.
So like Breeze Pale Malt or something similar
Breeze Pale Malt. I use a lot of the RAR two-row.
That's similar.
Yeah, and any of those are good. And again, if you want to add a little bit of toastiness, by all means, add, 10, 20, 30, 40% Maris Otter or Golden Promise or just an American pale ale malt. If you're looking for more of those flavors.
So you start with pale malt. What's the percentage of pale malt roughly?
I always work backwards. I'll add my specialty malts and the rest is pale malt, but usually in the 70% range. Not too far off of, a lot of other styles. But you're getting a bulk from, or not a bulk, you're getting a decent amount from the flaked, adjunct. Oats again are big, just plain old flaked oats, or I've also used Simpson's Golden Naked Oats that have a little bit more of a toasty flavor. And I think those work well with just the two row because you're getting a little bit of malt flavor from them. They can add sort of almost a berry flavor that can be very nice.
And what percentage was that again, the oats?
Like 20% oats flaked, or wheat.
Flaked oats, right?
Yep, flaked oats or Golden Naked Oats are almost like a very light crystal malt made out of oats. Just flaked wheat or malted wheat, any of those honestly will do a pretty good job adding protein that will help to give some of that haze, but also help to round out the body and give it a great head and all those sorts of things. And then for the rest of it, people do carapils. I'm not sold on carapils adding very much. If you steep it, you can get some dextrins from it, but when you mash it, the dextrins mostly will convert to fermentable sugars. It may have some higher proteins, but honestly, most of the manufacturers have been very sort of tight-lipped on exactly what carapils does or, what is the mechanism for it adding body or head retention.
It's essentially a very, very light caramel malt, right?
Yeah, exactly. But it when you add it to the mash, whatever dextrins are in there get converted and it doesn't have much flavor. So that's where I've gone to the chit malt because the chit malt has all these great proteins, long proteins that will sort of fill in another niche in your protein tapestry of head retention and haze and all those things.
So it's an under-modified malt, right? It's one that hasn't been fully converted.
Exactly. It's just almost very barely sprouted and then dried. And Best Malt makes it, and it's available from quite a few, at least online homebrew shops, if your local one doesn't carry it. And then some people just add, 2 or 3 or 4%, just Crystal 10, Crystal 20, caramel, something, lighter crystal malt, but not super light like a carapils. Right. And that's pretty much it. It really, you're for the most part focused on adding body and mouthfeel from the grains, head retention, and it doesn't have a big signature malt character in the way, say, an English IPA would. But again, a little bit more maybe than a West Coast IPA. And very few brewers are adding, say, sugar to their double IPAs, New England double IPAs, which is pretty standard for the West Coast.
And the mouthfeel is often described as fluffy or pillowy. How do you end up with a fluffy or pillowy IPA here?
Yeah, it's all of those things put together. I mean, it's low bitterness. Bitterness can be really sort of, particularly if you get high tannins, can really sort of grate on your tongue. Mm-hmm. The proteins from the wheat or the oats or the chit malt, the chloride from the water. I tend to go for a little bit lower carbonation just to help have it be soft. There are brewers who will do lactose. Our brewery is going to be vegan, so we won't be adding lactose to anything. But you could add maltodextrin if that was something you were interested in. You could, again, play with the hop iso extracts. I think it's also sort of slightly lower attenuation can help. So these beers tend to be mashed a little bit higher. The English yeast tend to be a little lower attenuating. Conan, in particular, the strain that the Alchemist uses that they got from the Vermont pub and brewery, can be very finicky. That, you know, depending on what generation, how many times you've repitched it, it can get a little lazy on you. Y yeast 1318 is sort of another one of the classic ones. Again, not really high attenuation.
Yeah, that's a pretty low attenuation one, I've heard.
Yeah. Yeah, about 70%.
I made a beer and it came out actually quite high with that particular yeast recently.
Yeah. White Labs 007 dry English ale is also another one that's a little more attenuative. Mm-hmm. And I've heard a couple of these brewers say that they've switched yeast a couple of times and that there's just something about these yeasts. There's some sort of interaction going on between the yeast and the hops that makes this magic. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of debate over exactly what that magic is. I think it's probably a combination of a few things. Certainly part of it is using a yeast that has a little fruity character, sort of adds on that fruitiness to the hops. But it also seems like there's probably something going on with thiols, which are these aroma molecules that hops contribute and then are often converted by yeast. It could be, you know, honestly, I don't know. But a big sort of feature is that you are dry hopping with a little bit of fermentation still to go. So you're giving more time for that yeast and that hop to get to know each other. And so there are a bunch of yeast strains out there. If you are a dry yeast person, the Safale SO4 is a pretty good option. I've done a few with that and had good luck. But all of that sort of builds up to that pillowy, soft mouthfeel. I think time is a big part of it too. When I used to brew sort of West Coast IPAs, I would tap them as quickly as I could. I would try to have them as fresh as possible. And these beers, I think partly it's just that super high dry hop rate. They benefit from a week or two in the keg just to have everything settle out. You can particularly tell some of these beers, it gets you right in sort of the back of the throat. That's almost this, I think it's just the lupulin that's just coating the back of your throat. And it makes you want to cough. And that really disrupts that very smooth, mellow character.
Well, walking back to the mash schedule, I assume you're going to use a higher temperature mash schedule. What are you mashing in at?
Yeah, 156 to 158 usually.
Yeah,
although,
that's pretty high, yeah.
Yeah, but it'll depend on the beer. I'm a low alcohol guy, so I'm usually in the 5.5-6% alcohol range. So I'm mashing hotter. For a double IPA, double New England IPA, I might back that down a little bit. And again, you just sort of have to balance things. You know, if you're using London 3 from Y yeast that's a little less attenuative, you might want to lower your mash temperature a little bit. If you want to use 007, which is a little more attenuative, you might want to raise the mash temperature. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you're looking for a final gravity in the sort of 10, 15 to 10, 20 range. So high, but we're not looking, you know, 10:30 or anything like that. Nothing too big.
And you talked quite a bit about hop varieties a little bit ago, but one of the interesting things, I think in some of the notes you sent me, that you're using a lot of English IP, I'm sorry, English type of hops as well in some ways?
I've used some German ones, some of these new German ones like Hallertau Blanc and Mandarina Bavaria and Huel Melon. I think there are some of more English hops coming out that have a more... fruity, tropical sort of flavor. There's a lot of excitement about South African hops, too, that have sort of passion fruity kind of aromas. But a lot of those, I believe the fields were owned by MillerCoors, since they are SAB Miller. And a year or two ago, they announced that they would not be supplying anyone other than Craft Brew Alliance or whoever it is, the aligned U.S. quote-unquote microbreweries that are owned in whole or in part by MillerCoors.
Right. Well, walk us through a typical hopping schedule. What does it look like and how's it a little bit different than what you might use for an IPA?
Sure. I mean, the biggest difference is that there's usually very little, if any, bittering addition. We're getting enough. We're going to add a big flame out addition, maybe something late in the boil. And there's really no point unless you just want, you know, a tiny little bit of hops to stop a boil over.
I mean, what's a bitterness level? I didn't even ask you that.
It's the problem with this. My calculator says one thing, but my tongue says another. They're usually, you know, sort of 40 to 50 is what's claimed. Honestly, it's could be lower or higher, because so much of the character isn't from those sort of typical long, you know, 60 minute Boyle editions that have a particular sort of, I don't know how to describe it. They have a certain sharpness to their bitterness. Yeah. And even sort of, I've tweaked the numbers in Beersmith. I've gone down to like a, I think from what is the default, like a 50% utilization correction for flameout to
the new version I have is going to have a temperature setting. So you can actually set a temperature for each one, which will be nice. And that'll give you the right curve, you know?
Cool. I knocked mine down. Excellent. I knocked mine down to 35, and that seemed to be getting closer to what I tasted, for my additions, just because as a home brewer, I'm adding hops and the boil is, you know, naturally cooling down about a degree a minute, as I'm whirlpooling and it's cold outside. And, often I'll add my first edition, just a little bit of Columbus at say 15 minutes. If I'm doing a double IPA, it might be a little bit of a bigger edition, you know, maybe 15 or 20 IBUs. If it's a lower, gravity beer, I might, you know, just be doing 5 or 10 IBUs and then whirlpool. And I'm a big advocate of adding those hops right at flame out, letting them steep in there for half an hour. You certainly could go for the lower, you know, cool the beer first or cool the wort first to 185 or 180 or 175 if you were worried about getting too much bitterness. But for me, I still want it to be an IPA. I still want to have some bitterness.
Below 175 or so, you don't really get much out of it, honestly. The utilization drops off pretty quickly.
Yeah. And I found, at least for my palate, that the flavor didn't change much. I know some people thought that maybe if you cooled it, you won't be volatilizing some of those aromatics. Maybe not, but for my palate, I didn't notice much of a difference between the hop character, excluding bitterness, from 180 versus 210. And be real generous with those additions. I mean, you know, an ounce per gallon isn't a crazy amount. You could go a little up or a little down from there, depending on, again, if it's a lower alcohol version, maybe go with, you know, 4 ounces in a 5 gallon batch. And if it's a double IPA, you know, go up to 6 or something like that. And again, use whatever sort of just characterful hops you want at that point. Columbus is great. Simcoe is great. This is a fine time to use some older hops. If you happen to have some of those hops in the freezer that are, you know, from two years ago, as long as they've been well stored and, you know, give them a smell and make sure they smell all right, I wouldn't worry about tossing them in. The beer I'm drinking now had some Simcoe from 2014, at flame out. It tastes fine.
Are you dry hopping a lot?
Oh yeah. A huge amount. I mean, again, some of these breweries, literally what, 8 pounds per barrel. So that's the equivalent of, you know, more than a pound in a 5 gallon batch. I don't go quite that high. But I certainly do, a couple of additions. I'll do one sort of just a little bit over 50% apparent attenuation. So if, you know, beer started at 1060, when it hits about 1030, so that would be, you know, 2 to 3 days in, usually, I add the dry hops. That first dose, I'll just add them loose to the fermenter. And that has a couple of advantages. Again, the yeast is active, and so if you introduce any oxygen at that point, it's a lot less of a concern. And we'll talk about it a little bit. These beers tend to be very oxygen sensitive. It's really good to get those hops in while the yeast is still working. They'll scrub any oxygen out. Yeast love oxygen. They'll help to circulate the hops. You know, a lot of home brewers don't have a pump that's going to recirculate the beer, like a professional brewer would, to keep those hops in suspension. And yeah, then give them a week to sort of, infuse and drop out. And hopefully in that time, because the yeast is still producing CO2, some of those sort of really volatile, fresh flavors will get blown off. And as a result, you'll have sort of less that green, grassy kind of
flavor. I was going to say, you're leaving in for a whole week, and that seems a little long to me. I think most people are down to, from what I've read, 24 to 72 hours is sufficient in most cases for dry hopping.
Yeah, for me, part of it is I'm throwing them in loose, and fermentation's still going on, so I'm waiting for the yeast and the hops to drop out before I go to the keg.
I see.
I have in the past, and we can talk about packaging later, but I have dry hopped on, you know, day 2 and then gone right into the keg on day 3 or 4 when fermentation's still going on. attached a spunding valve to allow CO2 to keep off gassing. But part of that is that's just the first edition. The next edition's in the keg. And for that one, since at this point the yeast is done, it's dropped out, it's not going to ferment anymore, I'll bag them or I'll use a metal screen, and then I'll put them into the empty keg. I'll flush the keg 4 or 5 times with CO2 just to remove as much of the oxygen as I can. And then, transfer the beer in. I've started playing with the direct fills, just going right in through the liquid post from the SS brew bucket. We'll spigot at the bottom. Honestly, I drink these beers fast enough that I haven't noticed a great extension in shelf life. It certainly may be the case that there is, but I don't have any beer left to check on it.
And of course, like most IPAs, you want to consume them quickly, right?
Exactly. But in this case, I like to give them at least say 10 days to 2 weeks cold on, I'll hook it up to CO2. I'll leave it in the kegerator and just let any of that suspended yeast, suspended hop particulate from the first dry hop drop out and then get sucked out in the first pint or two. And then after that, you have a relatively smoother experience. If you want to at that point, or if you're going to move the keg, you can jump it to a serving keg to get off that second dose of hops. But storing the beer cold, I've never had a problem with grassy flavors being extracted from cold beer. I just started playing with dry hopping and then priming the keg using CBC1, which is a relatively new yeast strain that's specifically for a cask and bottle conditioning. It's very quick. It only ferments simple sugars. So adding that second dose of dry hops to the keg, a tiny bit of sugar, 2 or 3 ounces, and then some rehydrated yeast. Again, trying to scrub out any oxygen, trying to soften those hop flavors maybe just a little bit more, and then jump it to a fresh serving keg.
Interesting.
A lot of options. So you can do the spunding thing, you can do that, but this is all designed to sort of, oxygen is the big enemy of hops. And so if you want these beers to be able to hold up to, say, 2 weeks of settling, and then a month or a month and a half of drinking, it pays to be extra careful. And that's one reason you see very few really terrific homebrewed bottled versions of these. It's a style that is very close to requiring kegging equipment. You can certainly try it with bottling, but again, if you can get a CO2 tank and even try to purge those bottles or something like that, but just even that little bit of extra oxygen can be deadly to the style.
So what does oxygen do in this case? I mean, oxygen in general is bad for your beer, but...
Yeah, the weird thing about this style, and it seems like it's probably related to the oats. It might be the manganese in oats, but it's not entirely clear what's causing it, but there's this amazing color change. I left a sample of one of my New England IPAs out overnight, and by the morning, I'd say it was 10 SRM darker. It was amazing. I mean, it almost looked like a brown ale or an amber ale after just that little bit of oxygen. And I posted a picture of it to my Facebook, and I had a couple of professional brewers chime in with pictures that people had sent them of their beautiful golden hazy beer that 3 or 4 weeks later, after being in a crowler or sitting in a keg line, had almost gone black. And exactly what's causing that is a hot topic of debate. It's not exactly clear what's going on or what's causing that. I would suspect it has something to do with all that protein. There's some suggestions it might be an enzyme similar to what happens when you bite into an apple and you have those polyphenols reacting and turning brown in a relatively short order. Whatever it is, it doesn't look good. That's one of the reasons, too, that you don't see many darker versions of this style. When you have hazy and dark, it can start to look very muddy until you get really dark, until you have a porter or something like that.
Interesting.
But then on top of that, just the hop aromas and the hop flavors really sort of die off. They really don't stand up to, and there really isn't much else in there.
Well, let's cover some related styles. You mentioned you had a few related styles to this one.
Yeah, so the next step in New England IPA at the moment is the sort of milkshake IPA. And so I mentioned lactose briefly earlier, but a lot of breweries, Aslan Brewing near me in Virginia and Tired Hands in outside Philadelphia, Omnipolo from Sweden or wherever they're from, have been doing these sort of essentially a New England IPA, maybe even a little less bitterness, but then with lactose, vanilla, and some sort of fruit. I'm just almost trying to make like a sherbety sort of flavor in the beer. playing those big, juicy hop aromatics with vanilla, which on its own can be a really nice addition, even without the fruit. Just again, sort of changing that perception of those fruit flavors from, you know, orange on its own can be very orange juice to, you know, plus vanilla is very orange Julius or orange creamsicle or something like that. Yeah, it softens
pretty much anything you put in it, right?
Yeah. And it's sadly, vanilla has gotten a lot more expensive in the last year or so. But, you know, as a home brewer, throwing in a bean or two isn't going to break the bank.
Yeah.
And then, you know, mangoes. I did a mango vanilla one on Nitro that was a lot of fun. People do peaches. People do... It tends to be sort of the paler fruits, apricot, rather than, you know, berries. No reason you couldn't. Grim Brewing does a couple of, I think they call them the Power Pop series, where they have, I'm sorry, no, those are sour.
The berries will come through much stronger. The flavor will come through fermentation a lot better, but.
Yeah, but I think it's just that cherry in the hop is sort of might not be it. There aren't many hops that have that sort of cherry character. You could do maybe El Dorado or something like that would play
currants, with. You know.
Yeah, pineapple is another popular one. Think about sort of what flavors you get from the hops, and then try to reinforce those with whatever fruit you select. But those were actually started. Tired Hands did the first one is sort of a joke. They're New England IPA, Northeast IPA, whatever you want to call it. Hop Hands had gotten a very poor review on a Beer Advocate from one of the site founders. I think they referred to it as, you know, undrinkable and hazy and murky or something, unsalable. And they then called it a milkshake beer. And they said, you know, we'll show you, we'll make this milkshake beer. And so that not only did they add all this fruit, but then they add the green apples and the flour just to make it really, really hazy, but really delicious, fun beer. And it's, hasn't gotten quite the excitement that sort of the New England IPAs have, but it's certainly, it's a completely different take on an IPA. You know, it's about as far away as you can get from Sierra Nevada Celebration as you can get.
Any others you wanted to mention real quick?
Any other commercial? Oh, no. And that's really it.
Milkshake IPA.
It's the style just has so much range. It's hard to say what, you know, in 5 or 10 years, what will be called New England IPA and what will be a new spin-off version. Certainly some of these beers now are there. Some breweries are blending in just a little tiny bit of Hefeweizen or Belgian yeast. And that really gives it a different character. Again, those are some, you know, they have big ester production. They're really fruity, but they also have a little of that phenolic undercurrent that will spice. If that's a separate style or if it's the same style, I'm not really sure.
Well, any final tips for making the perfect New England IPA?
Just watch your process, and it's like any style. You're not going to probably nail it on your first time. You know, pay attention to ingredient quality, you know, smell all your hops, pick one yeast strain and, try with a few different hop varieties to see what works out. Don't get carried away with too many hop varieties. I mean, to me, like two varieties is sort of the sweet spot, maybe three. Adding more hop varieties at each dry hop step doesn't add complexity unless it's done perfectly. Usually it just sort of muddies the flavor and you start, having a generic hoppy kind of flavor. Galaxy, Citra, Mosaic, Simcoe. Scott and I call these cheater hops just because it's hard to make a bad IPA when you load up with Galaxy or Citra. It really takes a lot of skill to make an IPA with Cascade or Centennial that really holds up to these new varieties that have huge oil content and big, bold, already tropical flavors, rather than trying to convert something that is not tropical into a tropical flavor. You're better off starting off with hops that already are pretty close to what you're looking for. Watch your oxygen, make sure you're filling your keg and there's as little oxygen as possible to get in contact. And this is a style that really, I think, is in some ways a savior for local breweries and for home brewing because they don't ship well. Sierra Nevada just came out with a beer called Hazy Little Thing that it's not quite a New England IPA, but just the idea that I don't think breweries are going to be able to do national distribution of these beers and have them hold up in the way that your local brewery or you can produce these beers and serve them and drink them, on tap where it was produced and have them at their peak, ride that wave down until it's not a great beer anymore and keep brewing them.
Well, did you want to say any words about you got the Sapwood Cellars opening up soon. What kind of beers are you brewing for that?
Yeah, well, our plan is to do a whole lot of hoppy beers, but to do a real range of them. I think there's so many fun things to do with these beers. And that's one of the great things about New England IPAs. It's really opened up the floodgates that you can be really creative and push sort of big, bold flavors that people are excited about. And so the goal will be to have, you know, maybe 7 or 8 hoppy beers on at any one time, you know, and certainly some beers on that lower end. We're playing with some of those blends of yeast to make maybe almost something like a wit, but with no spicing, just citrusy hops, very low bitterness, all the way up to, you know, a double IPA and some fruited IPAs and just all those sorts of things. We will be doing a whole lot of hoppy, a whole lot of sour beers as well, but those will take a little bit longer, hoping to have maybe 150 or 200 oak barrels within the first year.
Wow. Well, Michael, I really appreciate you coming on the show again. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure as always, Brad.
And again, my guest today was Michael Tonsmeyer. Michael is author of the book, Sour Beers, as well as the blog, The Bad Fermentationist. He's also an award-winning brewer, certified beer judge. And he's opening a new brewery called Sapwood Cellars in Columbia, Maryland this summer. Thanks again, Michael.
Cheers.
Well, a big thank you to Michael Tonsmeyer for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Their educational program lets you learn about every aspect of brewing in detail. Take advantage of their fantastic sale and get 20% off any of their courses when you use the offer code BEERSMITH2018 at learn.beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's BEERSMITH2018 at learn.beerandbrewing.com. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad. Record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the BeerSmith cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, BeerSmith Mobile. The mobile version of BeerSmith is a perfect complement to our desktop brewing software. Check out BeerSmith Mobile at BeerSmith.com/mobile or on the Google Play, iTunes, or Amazon app stores. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.